If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism.
In our last episode, I said that faith is a choice. The modern mind struggles to wrap itself around that idea because we use the word faith very differently than the Bible does. We think of it as a condition that one has, like being left-handed or having a nice singing voice. For us, it describes a state of mind, a feeling, a confidence or certitude in something that's unknowable or unprovable. For example, we don't use the word faith to describe observable or scientific facts. We don't have faith in the law of gravity or faith in prime numbers. We're supposed to just accept those as indisputable. For us, faith means that you believe in God without reason. But that's not quite how the Bible, or Catholic Christianity, uses the term. As we saw in the last episode, Abraham chose to believe God's promise to bring through him an innumerable number of descendants. And he believed it despite the circumstances of his life making it highly improbable. It was deliberate, a deliberate choice, and that made it in some sense more rational than emotional. It was like a bride and groom choosing to believe each other's promises at the wedding, and henceforth act on that trust. And so Abraham, even though he was 100 years old and Sarah was 90, chose faith and waited for God to deliver the son through which more sons would come than the stars of the sky or the grains of sand across the earth. But as we'll see in this episode, God tested the strength of Abraham's trust. Now, wedged between the story of Abraham laughing at the idea of two old people having a baby, and the birth of that baby named Laughter, is the troubling story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. With all this talk of laughter and babies, it seems weirdly out of place. But upon reflection, we realize that this story of fire and brimstone pouring down on wicked cities is right where it belongs, because it serves as the perfect contrast between the faith of Abraham and the faithlessness of the pagan world around him. If you remember, Abraham and his nephew Lot both had led very successful nomadic clans, each with vast flocks and herds. But as their flocks moved across the arid hills of Canaan, the herdsmen began fighting over grazing lands and watering holes. So the two had parted ways. Lot was enchanted by the cities of the plains beyond the Jordan River, particularly the city of Sodom and its neighbor Gomorrah. Lot didn't trust God like his uncle Abraham. In the city, men didn't need to depend on God's promises. In the city, they took control of their own destiny, and they made their own luck. Gradually, Lot had inched closer to the city, and then gave up the nomadic life entirely, moving into Sodom as a respected citizen. And this had already gotten him in trouble, as he had gotten mixed up in the constant wars between Sodom and its rivals. Uncle Abraham even had to bring his private army to rescue Lot, a prisoner of war, from a raiding party that had sacked Sodom. But Lot didn't learn his lesson. He went back. And that's where Lot is living when three strange men show up at Abraham's tent, where his clan is camped on the hills overlooking the plains beyond the Jordan River. Abraham immediately senses that something very odd is happening. He offers these three strange men hospitality, and Sarah prepares them a meal. And then they repeat the promise of God to give Abraham and Sarah a son. In fact, they tell them that the boy will be born the following spring. And then Abraham realizes that he is speaking to the Lord himself, who has appeared in the guise of a man with two angels accompanying him. After their meal, Abraham accompanies the Lord and the two angels as they walk to an overlook onto the plain. And God wonders if he should tell Abraham about his judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him? No, for I have chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that I may bring to Abraham what I have promised him." God then tells Abraham that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah is so wicked that he will send his angels to visit them to see if it is as bad as the Lord has heard. Now, of course, this is a figure of speech because nothing is hidden from God. In essence, the angels are there to give Sodom one last chance to repent. As the angels hike down from the hills toward the city, Abraham remains standing next to this apparition of the Lord. No doubt, he's thinking of his nephew Lot. And he asks God a question, which leads to a fascinating conversation. "Will you really destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous people within the city. Will you destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you, Lord, to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous fare no better than the wicked." And the Lord said, "If I find 50 righteous people in Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake." Abraham answered, I'm sorry to inquire of the Lord, for who am I but dust and ashes? But suppose you find only 45 righteous people. Will you destroy the whole city because they were five short?" And the Lord said, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 there." Again Abraham spoke, "Suppose you find 40 that are righteous." And the Lord replied, "For the sake of 40, I will spare it." And then he said, "Please do not be angry at me for speaking again, but suppose 30 righteous people are found there." The Lord answered, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." Abraham said, "Suppose there are 20, and the Lord answered, "For the sake of 20 righteous people, I will not destroy it." Abraham spoke one last time, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again but this once. Suppose 10 righteous people are found there." The Lord answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy the city." And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Now, what happens next is not complicated, but in the 21st century it has become very controversial because we no longer believe that sodomy is a sin against God. The two angels arrive at Sodom's gate at sunset. Lot was sitting in the gate as an elder citizen of the city. He invites them to spend the night in his house before they continue their journey in the morning. "Oh no," they replied, We'll just spend the night out here in the city square." But Lot insists, and he prepares a nice meal for them. But while they're eating, all the men of Sodom, young and old, came from all over the city, and they surrounded the house. They shout to Lot, "Where are the two men that came to spend the night with you? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Lot steps outside, locking the door behind him. He begs the men not to rape the angels in disguise. And then he tries to buy them off. Look, he says, "I have two virgin daughters. I'll bring them out to you, and you can do with them anything you wish. But please, leave these men alone, for they are my guests and are under my protection." "Stand back," the men shout. "Who is this guy? He moves to our city as an outsider, and now he judges our ways and customs. We'll treat you far worse than we're going to treat these strange men." They try to grab Lot, but the angels reach out and pull him back into the house and bolt the door. The men outside start trying to batter it down. But the angels do a little miracle, and they blind all the men, both young and old, that are trying to break down the door. This causes some confusion, and they temporarily stop trying to break in. Then the angels tell Lot that God has sent them to destroy the city, to completely destroy it for its wickedness. They tell him to gather his family and get them out by morning. So Lot rushes to tell his daughter's fiancés, but they just laugh at Lot. As dawn comes, Lot is still hesitating. He's not sure he wants to leave. Now the angels tell him to run because destruction is about to fall from heaven. Still, Lot dilly-dallies around until the angels grab Lot, his wife and daughters, and basically push them outside the city walls, ordering them to run for your lives and don't look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be swept away. And just as the sun is rising over the horizon, fire and burning sulfur rain down from the sky on Sodom and Gomorrah. They and the other cities of the plain, which Lot had chosen over life with Abraham, are wiped off the face of the earth. But as they are fleeing, Lot's wife is dragging at the rear of the party, and she does exactly what the angels warned them not to do. She looks back, and she is turned into a pillar of salt. After that, Lot and his daughters have nowhere to go, so they move into an isolated cave in the hills, far from any inhabited place. Now, in those days, being childless was not only a badge of shame, it was a practical disaster. There would be no one to provide for you as you aged. So his daughters, who obviously grew up in Sodom and were products of its perverted culture, come up with a scheme to get themselves pregnant. They get their father drunk out of his mind, and then they have sex with him. And they produce these two bastard sons, whose descendants eventually will become the enemies of the descendants of Abraham. Okay, so why is the narrative about Abraham and Sarah having the promised child interrupted by this sad, perverted story of Sodom, Lot, and his messed up family? Because it is an inversion of the covenant with Abraham. Abraham chose to believe and depend upon God, but Lot fell in love with the disordered pagan cultures of the cities. God will bless Abraham through fertility, even going so far as to put a sign on his and his male descendants' private parts to remind them that their seed carries the seed of humanity's redemption and restoration. Contrast that with the disordered homosexuality of Sodom, literally where we get the word sodomy. That seed does not lead to fertility and everlasting life, but to futility and death. Abraham looks forward to a future of sons and daughters spread out like the stars of the Milky Way. Lot, and especially his wife, look backwards toward Sodom. Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, will conceive a child. Lot's wife is turned into a pillar of salt in which life can never grow. As an old man, Abraham will make love to his elderly wife in his tent, in expectation of God blessing them with a son named Laughter, who will bless the world. As an old man, a drunken Lot is seduced in a cave by his own daughters to produce violent bastards who will be deadly enemies of Israel. You see, there are two ways, two paths. We can trust God, living within his order and purposes, choosing to believe his promises to bless us. Or we can live in alienation from him, directed towards ends for which we were not made. And that way always leads to perversion, disorder, and ultimately destruction. The contrast between the stories of Abraham and Lot could not illustrate that more clearly. The following spring, just as he said he would, God enabled Sarah to finally conceive, and she bore a son, who they named Isaac, as God had instructed them. And Abraham, now 100 years old, circumcised Isaac on the eighth day, as God had instructed him. Abraham and Sarah laughed when God promised the boy, but now they laugh in joy. Now, if the story ended there, it would be a delight. But it doesn't end there. Because, as I said at the beginning of this episode, God tested Abraham's trust. Most of you listening to this have heard the story many times. When Isaac is still a young boy, the pride and joy of his elderly parents, the promise made flesh, God tells Abraham, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering on a mountain that I shall show you." After making Abraham spend a lifetime waiting for this promised son, is this the punchline of a sick joke? What kind of monstrously cruel divine entity would command any parent to sacrifice, to murder their own child? Especially this parent with this child. But the key to understanding this story is God's description of Isaac, and it illustrates an important principle of biblical interpretation, or how we must read the story the scriptures tell. We read parts of the story in the context of the whole story. So early episodes make more sense as more and more of the plot unfolds, which retroactively unlock the meaning and significance of what seemed puzzling when we first read it. So, when God says, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and sacrifice him on a mountain," it's puzzling and disturbing. But when we later understand that God himself will send his son, his only son, whom he loves, to be sacrificed on a mountain, we see that this episode with Abraham had two purposes. First, it shows us that God's covenant with Abraham will continue to unfold until it is fulfilled in Christ. When we look backwards, we see the order and purpose of God's work. Jesus, the only Son of God, did not die by accident. It was always supposed to be this way. From the moment right after the fall of Adam and Eve that God prophesied that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent, and then gave them animal skins to cover their shame, God's plan has deliberately and carefully played out. The redemption and restoration of the creation is the point of the biblical story, and everything points to and moves toward it. Second, by describing Isaac as a foreshadowing of Christ, God is showing us how much he loves us. Is it horrible to think about sacrificing your son on some mountain? Yes, it's unfathomable. But as we stare into that unfathomable depth, we get a glimpse of the depth of God's love and mercy. He will pay any price to redeem and restore humanity and the creation that was broken with us. And so, as most of you recall, Abraham brings Isaac to the mountain that God showed him in the land of Moriah. They build an altar, and they stack the wood to burn Isaac's body. Now, Isaac is getting curious and maybe nervous and wondering where the lamb is for the sacrifice. But Abraham still chooses to believe. He tells Isaac that God will provide the sacrificial animal. The text makes it clear that Abraham will obey and sacrifice Isaac, but he still believes that somehow he won't have to. And at the last moment, before Abraham could strike his son with a knife, God reveals a ram with its horns caught in a thicket. Abraham chose to believe, and God kept his promise. Abraham sacrifices the ram, not Isaac. But because Abraham chooses to believe, chooses to trust God's improbable and seemingly absurd promise, God emphatically restates the promise as they stand next to the altar on that mountain in the land called Moriah. "Because you have obeyed me and have not withheld even your own son, your only son, I swear by my own name that I will certainly bless you. I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies, and through your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me." And it's important that this promise is restated here on this mountain. Why? What's so special about this particular mountain? Now, you remember in the last episode, I told you to remember Melchizedek, the mysterious priest who showed up to sacrifice to God when Abraham and his private army rescued Lot? He was, we were told, the king of a place called Salem, which I said would come up over and over and over again in the story the scriptures tell. Well, here it is again for the first time. Because the mountain that God shows Abraham, where God provided the sacrifice that spared Abraham's only beloved son, is Salem, Mount Zion. Later, King David will make it his capital city, Jerusalem. And on a rocky mount in Jerusalem, the temple will be built. And on that rocky mount, God will provide the sacrifice. Not Abraham's only beloved son Isaac, but a son descended from Isaac, and the only son of God, whom God loves. And it is here that the Sabbath of Eden will be restored on this mountain. For in the last scene of the Bible, the trees of life will line the streets of the heavenly Jerusalem in the new heaven and the new earth, yielding their fruit for the healing of the nations.